And now, it's time for our weekly news round. Lutheran Radio News with Paul Hill.
Thousands of landmines left over from past conflicts in the Middle East are being cleared away from an area close to where Jesus was baptized. The site in Kazer El Yahud in West Bank attracts more than 500,000 pilgrims every year, many of whom don't even realize how close they are to the explosives. A project will now clear away the devices that have lain near the holy site for nearly 5 decades. The place of Jesus' baptism is the third holiest site in Christianity. Organizers of the landmine clearing have had to satisfy quarreling church denominations as well as Israeli and Palestinian officials. To see a site that is visited by over 500,000 pilgrims and tourists each year, and for them to come in their buses and be so close to landmines, is very unusual, said James Cohen, the head of the Halo Trust, an international mine-clearing charity carrying out the project. We hope that pilgrims and tourists will be able to visit this site and celebrate the baptism of Christ in the way that was intended. Christians believe John the Baptist baptized Jesus at the site, a lush stretch of the Jordan River, flanked by desert. It is Christianity's third holiest site after the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, built on the spot where Christian belief says Jesus was crucified and resurrected, and the Nativity Church in Bethlehem, constructed on the site where tradition holds Jesus was born. The baptism marks the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, and many modern-day visitors don white robes and immerse themselves in the sacred waters in a show of faith. Churches were built near the holy site as early as the 4th century. Greek, Coptic, Syrian and Catholic churches, among several others, all had buildings in the area by the 1930s, erecting golden dome shrines and other structures. Israel captured the West Bank during the 1967 Middle East War and began planting the landmines on church land and in the surrounding area to protect it from enemies. Israeli officials say the booby traps laid by Palestinian militants are also among the 3,000 explosive devices in the baptism site's vicinity. A small path was cleared for Pope John Paul II's visit in 2000, and pilgrims for years have been forced to coordinate their visits with the Israeli military because of security and landmine concerns. In 2011, the site was finally officially opened to the public after Israel cleared a narrow road leading to the Jordan River. Today, buses ferry hundreds of thousands of visitors along that road each year, with the surrounding area remaining off-limits. The $1.15 million project is funded by Israel and private donors and aims to open up access to the area for pilgrims, clergy and tourists in about 1 year. The project began earlier in March, starting with work on the Ethiopian church's property, where barbed wire fencing with yellow danger mines warning signs encircling crumbling buildings. Bulldozers were used to hunt for the explosive devices. Within the area of the church, an armored vehicle dug into the earth, hoisting up a chunk of soil and then straining it through a sifter, searching for anti-personnel mines the size of a block of Camembert cheese. Even detecting the mines has proven to be a difficult task, with experts forced to comb through historical records, interview former Israeli soldiers, and survey old maps. Anti-tank mines with heavier charges are embedded to the west on an access road, while anti-personnel mines and booby traps are located within the church plots. But experts say identifying the mines isn't an exact process, with the ever-shifting topsoil of the Jordan River Valley displacing some of them. Drones, dogs, metal detectors and bulldozers have been used to sniff out the rest of the mines. It's a challenge that requires working slowly, in a safe way, and not to take any chances, said Marcel Aviv, the director of the Israeli Demining Authority, the INMAA. 8 churches are scattered across the nearly 250-acre expanse of land that borders the baptism site. The churches share custodianship of many sites in the Holy Land and often come into conflict on how to manage them. It took almost 4 years to get all denominations to agree to the terms of the project, a process that saw Cowan, the Halo Trust director, meet church leaders, including Pope Francis. Halo also waded into the Middle Eastern conflict, seeking approval to work on this site from Israel, which controls the area, and getting a green light from the Palestinians, who claim the West Bank as part of their future state. Majid Fatiani, the Palestinian governor of the nearby city of Jericho, welcomed the demining. We have been demanding the removal of these mines for a long time, he said. We are interested in removing these mines that were planted by Israel because this is our land. Representatives from both sides were brought in to supervise Halo's work. Jordan provides access to the baptism site from the other side of the river, and Cowan also met with the country's king to discuss the matter. We pray and hope that the clearance of landmines around the baptism site will contribute to peace and reconciliation in our region, which is very much needed at the time, Theophilus III, the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of the Holy Land, said in a statement. We are glad that after many years, pilgrims from around the world will be able to fully experience and venerate this holy site. Prejudiced parents are pulling their children from religious education classes because they don't want them learning about Islam, teachers have warned. Mothers and fathers are abusing their right to withdraw children from the classes, and this is hampering schools' attempts to prepare a child for life in modern Britain, the Association of Teachers and Lecturers annual conference heard. Delegates have agreed a resolution urging the government to take steps to prevent parents from selectively withdrawing their children, specifically from the teaching of individual religions. Proposing the motion, Richard Griffiths from the Union's Inner London branch said that RE today has developed into a subject that allows for critical thinking, big questions, allows children to explore their own and other religious beliefs and non-beliefs. He said the resolution was not against parents' right to withdraw youngsters, but was concerned about evidence which suggested an increase in the abuse of the right and the potential for it to be abused. Mr. Griffiths argued that the right, in the rare cases where parents' religious beliefs provided genuine grounds for the withdrawal, was very different to the cases of parents with certain prejudices, including Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, who wished to remove their children from certain lessons or visits to places of worship that would significantly hinder the ability of the school to prepare a child for life in modern Britain. He highlighted a recent investigation which indicated that there had been a 48% rise in hate-related crimes linked to race and ethnicity between 2015-16 and 2016-17. Mr. Griffiths told the conference, "I'm sure you are well aware of the dangers of the members of society closing themselves off to the rest of the world, the dangers of social media channeling an ever more extreme reflection of people's beliefs without balance, and the dangers of those children who are ignorant of other religious beliefs and non-beliefs and lack an understanding of the way that individuals, regardless of religion, can work together and make a positive difference to society, are increasingly vulnerable to targeting by extremists." Kim Knappett, the union's vice president, said she'd been shown a letter by a headteacher from a parent who was asking to selectively remove their child from RE, and that the letter was so foul, her answer was that they should refer it to the relevant authorities. She said in another case she'd been talking to students of different ages about RE in sixth forms, and they had told her they believed it was important that they learn about each other and to question and debate. The motion urged the union to work with others to determine the nature and extent of the selective use of the right of withdrawal. A Department for Education spokesman said, "Good quality religious education can develop children's knowledge of the values and traditions of Britain and help foster understanding among different faiths and cultures. Parents have the right to withdraw their children from all or any part of religious education, but schools should make sure that parents who want to do this are aware of the religious education syllabus and its relevance to all pupils." Churches have revealed a shortage of new organists, forcing worshippers to sing along to recorded music. Less than 4% of church organists are under 30, suggesting that they could become a thing of the past. Almost 50% of the churches that responded to a recent survey in the UK said that their organ player was over 70. Although 96% of the churches that took part said they had a working organ, there are just a lack of organists to play them. Instead, worshippers often have to sing along to music played over a PA system while the instrument lays idle, the Daily Telegraph reported. Music and Development Director Richard Hubbard, who wrote the report, claimed that the lack of new musicians could be down to the fact you have to be at least grade 5 in piano to start lessons. Therefore, it requires dedication from the pupil, as they have to also find access to an organ to practice on. Some of the churches complained that backing tracks didn't leave enough time between lines, which made them rush through songs. There is also a lack of togetherness if the congregation sing along to a PA system rather than a live musician. The PA system is also designed for speech rather than music, therefore it may not have quite the right effect. However, the Reverend Sue Leatherly of St Mary's Church in Mildenhall, Suffolk, said backing tracks were often better than the real thing. She said, "We've got used to it now, so it's okay. There are some that have voices on them, so it gives us a lead. We've got an organ with a choir or someone leading on the recording, and that is better than a single organ. It really helps us to sing together." Half of Jesus Christ's disciples were women, according to academics who say that the importance of his female followers has been overlooked for centuries. Bible scholar Helen Bond has said that while names such as Joanna, Susanna, and Salome are not as prominent as the 12 male apostles, they should be acknowledged as being key disciples. A key passage which Professor Bond refers to is in Luke, where Jesus appointed 70 or 72 disciples to heal the sick and spread the word about God. Although previously Dorotheus of Tyre, a scholar who died in 362 AD, argued these would have all been male, Professor Bond claims 2x2 may have meant half male and half female. She told The Times, "The phrase 2x2 reminds you of Noah's Ark and the idea that it is a male and a female. We are suggesting that Jesus has a much larger group of disciples, and that includes women as well, pairs of males and females together." Another passage in Luke 8 says, "The 12 were with him, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases, Mary called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out, Joanna, the wife of Chusa, the manager of Herod's household, Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them out of their own means." Many of these women would have helped preaching women-only spaces, as well as funding Jesus' travels. The research was broadcast in Jesus' famed female disciples, The New Evidence, a documentary broadcast on Channel 4 on April the 8th. During the program, the scholars will visit Horvat Kazra, an ancient chapel believed to be from the 1st century, which has Saint Salome written on the wall, the wife of Zebedee, and mother of the disciples James and John. Diarmaid McCulloch from Oxford University said that the Roman Emperor Constantine preferred a manly, militant Christianity, and after his rule, female saints were sidelined to the role of mothers and helpers. The Vatican has scrambled to clarify comments made by Pope Francis to a well-known Italian journalist that appeared to deny the existence of hell. The Holy See issued a terse statement saying a lengthy article published in La Repubblica on Wednesday by Eugenio Scalfari, 93, the newspaper's founder, was the fruit of his reconstruction and not a faithful transcription of the Holy Father's words. While the Vatican conceded that Scalfari, an atheist who struck up a friendship with Francis in 2013, had held a private meeting with the pontiff before the Easter weekend, it said an interview had not been granted. During the meeting, Scalfari asked the Pope where bad souls go, to which he was quoted as responding, "They are not punished. Those who repent obtain God's forgiveness and take their place among the ranks of those who contemplate him, but those who do not repent and cannot be forgiven disappear. A hell doesn't exist. The disappearance of sinning souls exists." The Vatican said the literal words pronounced by the Pope are not quoted, and no quotation of the article should be considered as a faithful transcription of the words of the Holy Father. Scalfari is said to pride himself on not taking notes or recording high-profile interviews, but this is not the first time he's been accused of misrepresenting the Pope. In 2014, he was rebuked by the Vatican for an article saying Francis had abolished sin. The friendship has been criticized in the past, with Scalfari once saying that it was the Pope who asked for the meetings, as he liked to exchange ideas and sentiments with non-believers. The Catholic Church's teachings affirm the existence of hell and its eternity, saying the chief punishment of hell is eternal separation from God. Pope Benedict XVI said in 2007 that hell really exists and is eternal, even if nobody talks about it much anymore. While in 1999, Pope John Paul II announced that hell was the ultimate consequence of sin itself, rather than a place. Hell indicates the state of those who freely and definitively separate themselves from God, the source of all life and joy. A drunk woman who attacked a group of Jehovah's Witnesses on her doorstep with a claw hammer after they tried to convert her to Christianity has avoided time in jail. Kerry Mitchell has downed 2 bottles of vodka and 8 cans of strong lager over 24 hours when she lashed out at the 3 victims who had knocked on her door. The 44-year-old from Tunbridge Wells in Kent flew into a rage when 5 Jehovah's Witnesses called at her flat to discuss the Bible. Appearing at Maidstone Crown Court, Mitchell admitted racially aggravated harassment, possessing an offensive weapon, and 3 charges of common assault. When Mitchell's doorbell was rung on January the 9th, her response was, "What?" Victim Jessica Chapman replied on the intercom, "We are calling to speak to you about the Bible." Trevor Wright, prosecuting, said, "She marched up to the main door, flung it open, and approached Jessica. She was throwing her arms about in a very angry and upset manner. She said, 'My son is dead and my husband is not giving me a Christmas present.'" The 5 religious callers said they were sympathetic to her, but the defendant pushed Mrs. Chapman in the chest, causing her to stumble backwards, before Mitchell then grabbed another Jehovah's Witness, Anne Margent, by the coat and pulled her forward. And Mrs. Chapman begged Mitchell to stop her attack by saying, "She is an elderly lady, let go." Mitchell replied, "Well, my husband is 73. Mrs. Marchant's husband, Mike, turned to see Mitchell shouting and screaming as she brandished a hammer and lashed out, hitting him on the shoulder. He grabbed hold of Mitchell's arm, but she would not let go and kept trying to swing the weapon, shouting, "My son has died and I'm grieving." Anne Marchant put her handbag in the way to protect herself, and the hammer was eventually wrestled from Mitchell's hand. A builder who came over to see what was happening was also verbally abused. Judge Jeremy Carey sentenced her to 4 months for possessing an offensive weapon and 4 months consecutive for the assaults, but suspended the jail term for 18 months. He also criticised his powers on sentencing when imposing 8 months imprisonment suspended for 18 months. Despite saying a hammer blow to the head could easily kill or shatter a skull, the judge ruled the public would be better served by rehabilitation. He said the fact that you are an overweight, 5'2" middle-aged woman and a drunk would not have prevented fracturing a skull from happening. The court heard Mitchell had a number of previous convictions for assault, but had not offended since 2009. Mitchell was also fined £200 for religiously aggravated harassment and will be subject to a tagged 6-month curfew from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. and a 20-day rehabilitation activity requirement to address her alcohol addiction. And finally, take the highway past the Dutch village of Jelsum and the road will play you a tune. Created by strategically laid rumble strips as a way of livening up journeys across the flat landscape, the novelty has worn thin for locals who say the constant droning melody is driving them mad. The tune is created when car tyres drive over the strips, which are usually deployed at the side of major roads to warn drivers they are straying off course. If hit at the correct speed, 40 miles an hour, the road will sing out the anthem of the Friesland region, a northern part of the Netherlands that has a distinct language and culture. But it is loud and the sound travels, and locals say the musical road has created a never-ending cacophony that keeps them awake at night. The Friesland Authority has agreed to remove the rumble strips later this week.
My name is Paul Hill. Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. Lutheran Radio News will be back next Friday. Until then, every blessing to you and goodbye for now.
On your PC, tablet, mobile phone and internet radio receiver, this is Lutheran Radio UK.